From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Benjamin Franklin holds a special place in the hearts of many Americans. He was so much more than a founding father. He was a renowned scientist, the man who flew a kite in a storm to prove a theory about electricity, a consummate diplomat in London and Paris, a media tycoon and a biting satirist, a legend in his lifetime and ever since. Legions of schoolchildren pay homage to him in book reports and school plays. To his critics, he was a man lacking moral gravity, a lightweight with little spiritual depth, perhaps rather too fond of the quick quip and the well-turned phrase. But now, in a new biography, former CNN head Walter Isaacson makes the case for America's favourite founding father once again, calling him the most accomplished American of his age and the most influential in inventing the type of society America would become. Tonight we're talking with Walter Isaacson about Benjamin Franklin, the man behind the myth. What does the name Benjamin Franklin mean to you? Do you see glimmers of his patriotic ideals in America today? Do you believe that his ideas still underpin the America of the 21st century? Join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, joining me now from New York is Walter Isaacson, former chairman and CEO of CNN and managing editor of Time. He's the president of the Aspen Institute and author of the new biography, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life. Walter Isaacson, thanks very much indeed for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Robert. It's good to be with you.
Also with me in the studio is tonight's On Point News analyst, Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University, author of Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity and Adoption. Randall Kennedy, good to see you.
Thank you so much.
Now, Walter Isaacson, anybody who looks at your book is left in no doubt. You really like Benjamin Franklin. Why?
Well, I mean, it's hard not to like him, even though he's filled with all sorts of flaws. He's a flesh-and-blood character, a person who had these basic working-class, populist, and democratic values that are easy to dismiss. It's easy to be snobby about some of them. But, you know, he was the original rags-to-riches in America, and he helped set that framework for American Main Street values.
I went to school in Britain. I did not learn very much about Benjamin Franklin. You will not be surprised to hear.
Oh, he lived there for 15 years.
Yeah, I know. It skated over in my history class, I'm afraid. In one sentence, his significance to the birth of this country?
He was the one who imposed the notion of religious tolerance on this country when it wasn't going in that direction. That was the most significant thing he did.
He wasn't a saint, was he?
Definitely not a saint. As you mentioned, he lacked a certain moral gravity. He was rather complacent because he was a bit smug, a bit proud of himself. He also, like all the founders, you have to wrestle with the issue of slavery. And he wrestled with it his entire life. You know, a couple of points in his life, he owned two household slaves. But then he started printing anti-slavery tracts in his newspaper. And he ended his life as the head of the president of the Society for the Abolition of Slavery, because he realized that was the one part of his life where he hadn't fought absolute tyranny, and he should have.
I thought it would be fun, after I looked through your book a little earlier this evening, to draw up a charge sheet against him as if I were presenting a case for the prosecution.
Absolutely.
Shallow, compromiser, dissembler, manipulator. Plead guilty to any of that?
He was a compromiser. He was a compromiser, especially in the Constitutional Convention, when everybody was standing on principle. There are people standing on principle saying there should be direct election of the Congress. There are people standing on principle saying states' rights and we should have equal representation by state. He said when he was a tradesman, he had to make a good joint on a piece of wood, making a table, that you sometimes had to take a little from one side, take a little from the other side to make the joint fit. And then you got a joint that was very stable. After that, he proposed the motion that you'd have a House representing the people, a Senate representing the states. He was able to carry that motion. And in the end, he said, you know, compromisers may not make great heroes, but they do make great democracies. Because compromisers are people who understand that you got to respect the other person's opinion as well.
And did that make him different from the other founding fathers?
Yeah, a lot of them were on their pedestals even before they died. They felt they were made of marble. They thought they were demigods, that sort of thing. Franklin was much more down to earth. He made a list of 12 virtues that he wanted to acquire in himself. And being a proud guy, he showed him around. He showed him around to some Quaker friend of his who said, you know, you forgot one virtue. And Franklin said, what was that? And he said, humility. You're a little too proud showing these things around. You need the virtue of humility. Franklin said he was never perfect at acquiring the virtue of humility, but at least he learned to feign humility. He learned to pretend to have humility. And he said that the pretense of humility was just as good as having the real thing because it kept you in line and made you respect the opinions of others.
Sounds a bit like the man who said that if you can fake sincerity, you've got it made.
Samuel Goldwyn, by the way.
Now, I was intrigued to learn, I never knew, he was very much older than many of the other founding fathers. He was, what, 70 years old compared to Jefferson's 33?
That was when they did the Declaration of Independence together. And Franklin was the editor for Thomas Jefferson. It was this week in history, of course, the July 4th week. And Jefferson is sitting in a rented room a couple of doors away from Ben Franklin's house on Market Street in Philadelphia. And the youngest, almost the youngest of the delegates, not quite the youngest, Tom Jefferson, is writing it on the little lap desk he invented. And he sends it over to Ben Franklin to be edited. He said, you know, would you kindly, in your wisdom, show me the way to make this a better document, because people were much nicer to editors back then. And Franklin took the phrase that Jefferson had used to set up the document, which was, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. And Franklin took his printer's pen and crossed out with heavy backslashes the last three words and changed it to, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And Franklin had come from Puritan Boston, your hometown there. And, you know, he did not want to say that the truths of our Constitution were sacred. He said, these are not assertions of religion, they're assertions of rationality and of reason. And we have to create a state that doesn't depend on religion for its rights.
But I'm intrigued by the nature of the relationship between this this wise old man, this 70-year-old man, and these much younger, perhaps, as you suggest, even more principled other founding fathers. Did they like him?
Oh, they looked upon him as a sage, occasionally a doddering old sage. As you say, he was 70 when Jefferson was half his age. And by the time they get to the Constitutional Convention, you know, Franklin's 80. He's almost 84. He is twice as old as the average age of the rest of the members, and he's 30 years older than any of them. And so they look upon him as the wise sage. He's very silent at times. He says very little. But they did like him. He was genial. He was very non-confrontational. The one thing about being willing to compromise and willing to be genial is that people like you. You don't make a lot of enemies. And although he had made some enemies in his time, especially when he was over in London, by the time he was in his 80s, he was totally revered. He was the most famous American in the world and the best-loved American in the world.
I want to talk to you about that period in London in a moment. As you can imagine, I was especially interested in that. But let me just bring in Randall Kennedy here. Do you like this guy?
I respect him. And I think that Walter Isaacson has done a fabulous job of presenting the brief for Ben Franklin. I must say, though, that one hears so many good things. There's so much drum beating for the founding fathers that in this country that my anxiety level, my skepticism level goes way up in the presence of a brief for the founding fathers. I'd like to go back, for instance, to the slavery question. It's true that that Franklin manumitted the slaves that he held, but he did that late in life. And he was a compromiser, so much so that he, too, along with the other founding fathers, allowed this terrible impediment to real democracy to be embedded in the very heart of this country. So one thing that I guess I want to ask of Franklin and of the other founding fathers is, you know, how do they look from the point of view of a slave in their era? How do they look from the point of view of Native Americans in their era? I'm afraid that oftentimes the answer is a rather dismal answer. Franklin's a bit better than his colleagues, but still my suspicion is that he needs to be judged a little bit more harshly than we're hearing.
Judged by the standards.
You know,
Walter Isaacson, come on.
Let me answer Professor Kennedy, because that's a great point. the reason we have to wrestle with the founders is we have to wrestle with them flaws and all. As Professor Kennedy, I'm sure, would agree, it's hard to wrestle with America and the way it was founded and July 4th and the Declaration of Independence without wrestling with slavery. And I hope in my book, and I would hope that most people, when they write about the founders, and most people don't actually, but, you know, you do have to be very aware of these flaws, and you have to say, America, you've got to confront the flaws of your founding as well as the greatness of your founding. And I found Franklin a good vehicle for that, because he looked back on his life, and he had tolerated and compromised on slavery. And he believed you could compromise almost anything. And at the end of his life, he realized there was one thing you couldn't compromise on, and it was slavery, and that he had done so. And so, you know, the last things he writes, the last hoaxes and the last parodies, as well as the last speeches, are all as the president of the Society for the Abolition of Slavery, because he gets very worked up on that issue. I'm not trying to just defend Franklin. I'm saying that part of understanding our own history is wrestling with and understanding our relationship to slavery. And by sweeping it under the rug, we do ourselves a disservice. And that's why you've got to confront it when you confront the founders.
But doesn't it also raise the question about whether men like Ben Franklin should be studied as a man of his time or as a man for all time? Is he a man whose ideas, whose ideals, whose writings still resonate down the ages, or are they to be looked at simply as a product of their time, obviously respected, analyzed, studied, written about, and all of that? But the book closed, time has changed.
I think that if somebody doesn't transcend their own times and their judgments, their moralities, their discoveries, or their science, they're not as great. And I try to show where I do think he does transcend the limitations of his time as one of the leading forces of the Enlightenment as it comes into America during his youth. On the other hand, you also have to look at where somebody is not able to break away from his times. Franklin, fortunately, offers us both examples, because the young Franklin is not able to break away from it. The older Franklin is.
Randall Kennedy.
It's one of the joys, by the way, of living to be 86 years old. You eventually get something right.
Randall Kennedy, do you see something in Ben Franklin which still resonates today, something he said, wrote, did, which still is something to be valued today?
Well, I think that, sure. For one thing, he clearly was entrepreneurial. He had a real, he was an entrepreneur himself, and he was a supporter of entrepreneurial values. That's certainly one of the central values in American life. And indeed, Americans, of course, have exported entrepreneurial values around the world. So I would agree with Walter Isaacson that he is, that Franklin is a person who had insights, who had values that, that do resonate in our current day. It seems to me that in judging people, you have to judge them in their time and also from the time in which you were writing. To say that you're judging somebody in their time, you also have to take into account what others in their time are doing. And though Franklin was, in certain respects, a real Democrat, again, one has to have, you know, you have to have your critical antenna up. There were people who were more Democratic than him as well. But to answer your question directly, sure, Franklin speaks to our time.
And Walter Isaacson, you would argue that compromiser though he was, in British Blairite political terms, an advocate of the middle way, as perhaps in London it would now be called, this was a man who did have principles and who worked and who fought for them.
Yes, I think your analogy is very apt. He was sort of a third way or a middle way type person, very much against the partisanship or fighting or disputatiousness. He said the only people who are good at disputations are people who are born in Edinburgh, and we should not try this in the United States.
And they are not represented here tonight. We're talking tonight with former CNN head Walter Isaacson about his new book, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life. Walter Isaacson is a fan of Citizen Ben. How about you? What about Ben Franklin still rings true for you today? His wit, his patriotism, his unique vision of American democracy. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former CNN head Walter Isaacson about his new biography of Benjamin Franklin. What do you think was his influence on today's America? Do you remember him as an inventor, as a diplomat, as a patriot who marched to his own drum? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Walter Isaacson, we talk about him as a scientist. Even I had heard about the kite and the storm. There's some doubt about it, whether it actually happened, isn't there?
There's a little bit of doubt. I don't doubt that he actually flew the kite. You have to remember that he proposed the experiment, which was one of the most significant experiments of that century, proving that lightning was electricity. And he proposed a way of doing it using a sentry box, a big platform, and a huge steel rod and wires coming down from it. And that was done in France, according to his specifications, and his theory was proved. And after that theory was proved, and he became incredibly famous for it, he mentioned, he said, I happened to do it another way, or, you know, it happened to be another way to do it, and that was flying a kite. He would not, and he was not taking credit for being the first to do the experiment, so it doesn't really ring true to me that he would be lying about it. He never lied about his scientific experiments, and they certainly put up lightning rods in Boston and Philadelphia right afterwards.
Let's take a call now. Peter's on the line from Lexington, Massachusetts. Peter, do you like Ben Franklin?
Do I like Ben Franklin? I honestly know very little about him, but I'm intrigued by what I'm hearing tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Great program, and it's a pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Isaacson.
Great talking to you, Peter.
My question is, thinking about great compromisers, you can't help but think of Bill Clinton. And I'm struck by your comment that Franklin felt that compromisers add to democracy, and I think perhaps those who liked Bill Clinton and supported him felt that he added to democracy as well. But I was wondering if there's any way to meaningfully compare the kinds of critics that Franklin had to the kinds of critics and detractors and enemies that Bill Clinton has.
Well, I'm going to go on dangerous turf here.
Go on.
But they did share a certain type of critic in the sense, not just for being, quote, compromisers, but, of course, Benjamin Franklin's critics and most vicious enemies were the ones who criticized his sex life. I mean, he was rather flamboyant and joyful in having girlfriends on various continents and various places, and had an illegitimate son, which he made no bones about. He took pride in his illegitimate son and helped raise him. So, especially in the great elections of the 1760s in Pennsylvania, that was, what was written then makes what was written about Bill Clinton and his sex life in the Star Report pale in comparison. They were writing all sorts of doggerel and poetry about it. But let me add a little bit of something about Franklin as a compromiser, because I was copying a plea for him on something that I thought was an important moral principle, which is he respected the opinions of others and tried to accommodate them when he made a great country. But there were certain things he did not compromise. I would argue slightly with Professor Kennedy in terms of among the founders, I think he was the most democratic. He always fought for every single thing that would avoid demeaning the spirit of the common worker, the common person, and give more democracy and more direct election. He also felt that religious tolerance was an issue that could not be compromised. So he was not a compromiser on his fundamental beliefs.
When he was in London, Walter Isaacson, he called it wrong, didn't he, on the one issue which I learnt about, taxation, no taxation without representation, the loathed Stamp Act. He thought it would be okay.
Yes, that's where his spirit of compromise and accommodation got him in trouble. He was trying to hold the British Empire together. He loved the British Empire. He probably wanted to be an office holder in the British Empire. In fact, he was an office holder. He was the postmaster for the colonies. So he's trying to hold things together. They pass the Stamp Act. He's against the Stamp Act, but they pass it. He said, well, let's make the best of it. And he even nominates a friend of his to be the Stamp Act collector in Philadelphia. The friend gets his house burned down and almost gets tarred and feathered. So it was not exactly the friendliest gesture in the world that Franklin had done for the poor gentleman. But it was Franklin having a bit of a blind spot about the radicalism that was then growing in the colonies on the issue of taxation.
You can't help but admire a man who has the political skill to be able to climb back from that, because by the account in your book, I mean, that got him into a lot of trouble back home.
He had great PR skill. He was able to write all sorts of anonymous letters to the editor defending himself and stories. And he writes some wonderful parodies, like an edict from the King of Prussia that he publishes in the British papers, in which the King of Prussia decides that that he can tax the British. And he uses the same arguments. He says, you know, the British, we helped defend them in wars. They used to be our colonies, so we should be able to tax them. And it was a parody to try to show how ridiculous the British position was.
Randall Kennedy.
I would agree with what Mr. Isaacson said about among the founding fathers, he was the most democratic. I was talking just in terms of political actors in general. I had in mind people like, for instance, Tom Paine.
I thought that's who you had in mind.
But let me ask another thing. Getting back to the question of personal life, one thing that comes across in this, again, very fine biography, question arises, would one have wanted to have been close, or what could one have gotten close to Franklin? I mean, as a person, for instance, with his family, he didn't seem like an awfully good family man.
I absolutely agree. You know, there was a certain lack of intimacy with his own family. He was deeply committed to his son, William, this illegitimate son I mentioned. Loved the kid, raised him. But then they break when William becomes loyal to the crown. He's royal governor of New Jersey, stays loyal to the British. And in 1775, Franklin breaks with him bitterly, and tries to steal away the affection of the grandson, William's own illegitimate son, a beautiful kid named Temple. And Benjamin Franklin and the grandson Temple Franklin form an alliance against poor William Franklin. They go off to France together. And so it's not only a soap opera, but a wrenching emotional soap opera in which Franklin is somewhat just has a practical and pragmatic relationship with his wife. It's not a deeply romantic marriage.
He left her on her own for years at a time, didn't he?
Yeah, she hated to travel. He loved to travel. And I guess they just made it an accommodation. I guess we could get back into the Clinton realm, but it would probably be best that we don't. As I say, I love Benjamin Franklin. We see all of ourselves in him, including some of our own flaws. And I am hoping to portray him as a person who is deeply flesh and blood human, who makes mistakes, who is at times too accommodating, and in some ways is not a great family man. And that's one of the flaws. He does not form this deep emotional bond. And he forms deep emotional bonds with other women, but in some ways he's a bit cavalier with his male friendship. So as a person, he could be a bit shallow in terms of the relationships he formed.
Let's hear from Nick, who's calling now from Gorham in Maine. Nick, you want to make the case for John Adams, do you?
Well, David McCullough's book on John Adams makes it sound like that Adams had some concerns with Franklin, that he was sort of a laggard, didn't really carry his share of the weight over in England. So I wonder what the relationship between Adams and Franklin was really like.
It was a wonderfully complex relationship, and I love David McCullough's book, and he does a great job portraying it. Their relationship starts in 1776, when they're both in Congress, and Lord Howe has come over from Britain with a peace feeler to see if we can stop this revolution. And Adams is a little bit worried that Franklin would be too likely to accept it, that Franklin, once again, would be too much of an appeaser or a compromiser. So they travel together to Staten Island to go meet Lord Howe, and they stop at an inn on the way, and there's only one room. So they have to share a small bed in this one room in an inn, which is a beautiful scene to me, the two of them together in bed. And Franklin has just developed a theory that the way you catch cold is not from being cold, but you catch cold from germs. It's contagion. He happens to be right, but nobody else believes it at the time. And so he insists that they keep all the windows open. And Adams is freezing. And they talk, throughout the night, Franklin is trying to explain his theory on the contagious nature of colds, as Adams is arguing that they close a window. But in Adams's diary, he finally says in an amused way, he fell asleep and left Franklin there babbling away about his theories. Later on, they become a bit more rivals, especially in Paris. because Adams takes a very tough line against the French government, whereas Franklin is trying to seduce the French government, charm the French government. And they finally kick Adams out. They declare a persona non grata. They're not going to deal with John Adams. And so it's Franklin who's able to, you know, forge the relationship with France that ends up winning the revolution.
I love that story about the common cold. Randall Kennedy, I want to put to you a sentence from Walter Isaacson. Franklin invented the type of society that America would become, representing the ideals of democracy, tolerance, and humility. Do you buy that?
Well, that's giving Franklin an awfully big piece of the cake. I think probably too big a piece. But on the other hand, Richard Hofstadter, a wonderful historian, once said that any good point should be able to bear the strain of a bit of overstatement. So I think that the important point here is that Ben Franklin, for all of his for all of the attention he's been given, he really is not in the top tier of founding fathers. And I think that maybe one of the things that Mr. Isaacson is attempting to do is to sort of make a case that he ought to be even higher than he has traditionally been. I mean, you say founding fathers in the week of July 4th, and people immediately say Jefferson, Adams, Washington, Madison. They don't typically include Franklin. So am I right that one of what you're up to here is to put Franklin in the top five?
Exactly. I do think Franklin, and he's older than the others, deserves to be in the top tier, partly because he's the one who sees most clearly the notion of religious tolerance, which I think is, you know, when we look at it now from our age, especially the 21st century and what we're going through now, this notion of tribal, ethnic, and religious tolerance, the reason he flees Puritan Boston and goes to the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia. He imposes that throughout the founding documents, and he's the only founding father who's involved with all the founding documents. He's the only one who both did the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and of course he did the treaty with France and then the peace treaty with England, and he forged the first Albany Plan of Union to federate the colonies back in 1754. So he was the one who best saw how we would become a federal union and best saw how the spirit of religious and ethnic tolerance was going to be the saving grace that would make America exceptional.
We have a caller who wants to ask you about one of those documents. John is on the line from Boston. John, hi.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah.
Hi. I'm dying to know, what was Ben Franklin, since he edited the or helped Thomas Jefferson, that the phrase, all men are created equal, and the slavery, I mean, what were they thinking? What doublethink was going on, and what were they trying to address when they could say that so boldly and still know that they weren't going to address slavery?
You're absolutely right, and he cites the phrase vociferously and often when he becomes the president of the Abolition Society. He says that if there's any truth to our founding claim that all men are created equal, we have to say they are created equal without regard to color. And that's the duty of Congress to do that. I think, you know, at that point, Franklin had turned against slavery. Jefferson had not. And I think Professor Kennedy probably knows more than I do, but I've tried to wrestle a bit with what Jefferson was thinking, because he was a slave owner throughout his life. You know, Franklin, who was from Philadelphia, came to the realization much earlier.
Professor Kennedy?
Well, one of the interesting things about the founding fathers is that virtually all of them, of the top ones, the top five, the top ten, most of them were anti-slavery, Jefferson included, George Washington included. Now, the question becomes, how do you view that? There's some people who cite that to vindicate them. I think there's another point of view, which is that makes them more morally culpable. The fact that they saw slavery as a wrong, and they did, makes them actually more morally culpable. If they had not seen slavery as a wrong, of course, you'd still disagree with them, but at least they wouldn't have been hypocrites. At least there wouldn't have been this internal tension. Again, we're talking about Ben Franklin, and Franklin was considerably better than most of his colleagues.
But when they wrote those words, "all men are created equal," is it your belief that they meant those words to be understood as including, in parentheses, including slaves?
Yes, I do. And I think that most of them had the idea that at the current moment, for just practical, brute reasons of politics, nothing could be done about slavery. But the founding fathers had the belief that slavery would go. Most of them were anti-slavery. Most of them wanted the abolition of slavery. By the way, I should also add that most of them also, not only did they want to get rid of slavery, but they also wanted to get rid of blacks. They wanted to ship blacks back to Africa.
Not Franklin.
Franklin,
of course, started schools for blacks across the colonies. And I think, Professor Kennedy, I'm not sure it was a... was it Father Bray or something, or the Bray schools, they were called. And that's what turned Franklin around early on, is founding these schools, because he believed that if you were going to get rid of slavery, that was not enough. You mm-hmm. also had to help people get jobs, get educated. You just couldn't take 700,000 slaves in a population of 4 million in America and turn them free without education, without jobs. And so he helped create a system of schools, and then he went to those schools and he wrote to his wife and to others about how he had learned that freed slaves, the Africans, were just as good intellectually, morally, at learning, at diligence, at industry, and that they needed to found more of these schools. But a lot of the founders thought it was going to be a problem to just unleash the institution of slavery.
And just one other thought. Here we are, three males discussing this. Did they expect the words "all men" to include the words "and women"?
I'll let Professor Kennedy take that. I don't think Franklin addressed that too much. He was he believed in education for women as well as for men, and he occasionally wrote about the need for more equality among the sexes, but I don't think he ever fought for the women's right to vote.
No, and most of the other founding fathers didn't either. They believed in a rigidly stratified society. They believed that women, they respected their women, but, you know, so long as they kept their place. And politics, of course, was the domain of men.
And you make the point, Walter Isaacson, more than once in the book, that Ben Franklin seemed to enjoy the company of women, and I don't only mean as a sexual partner, far more than he enjoyed the company of men.
He liked the intellectual and emotional stimulation he got from women, and the women in his life, be it Polly Stevenson on Craven Street off the Strand in London, or the two girlfriends he had in Paris, Madame Brillat and Madame Helvetius, were both great thinkers, philosophers, and some of his greatest scientific and philosophical letters are written to them, because he liked to engage the minds of women. He felt there was something just much more satisfying.
Stay with us, Walter Isaacson. We're talking tonight about Benjamin Franklin, America's favorite founding father, with the former CNN head Walter Isaacson. Do you see a little bit of Ben Franklin in America today? Do you think that perhaps his humor, his pragmatism, his civic sensibility helped to shape the American character? Have any of his ideas... I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life and the legacy of Benjamin Franklin with former CNN head Walter Isaacson. Do you remember reading about Benjamin Franklin in grade school, about his experiments with electricity, about his Poor Richard's Almanac? What is it about Ben Franklin that makes him an icon of American history now in the 21st century? You can join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Walter Isaacson, we've not mentioned yet Ben Franklin's time in Paris. He loved the French and they loved him.
Boy, did he love the French. And I think he would have spent the rest of his life there if he had not felt compelled to come back the very waning days for the Constitutional Convention. He liked the French because they were seductive and charming people. It's the same reason that John Adams hated the French. You know, John Adams was very dour and very solid, and somewhat priggish and prudish, and Franklin was very, very flirtatious. And I don't just mean with women, but he was flirtatious with ideas, with men, with charming people and stuff. And he found the French to be the most delightful. He said he wrote a letter saying it was the only nation that had no natural flaws. You know, the British were a little bit too stuck up. The Scots were a little bit too stubborn, and the Germans were a little bit too rigid, but the French had no flaws.
We were drawing parallels with modern American experience a few moments ago. Here was a man, an American diplomat, essentially, went over to Paris to plead America's cause, to win French support. It's been done more recently with rather less success.
You know, he went over with two things in mind. He was a traditional balance of power diplomatist. He understood that he had to balance France, Netherlands, the Spain off against England in order to get France on our side on the revolution and make it seem like it was in France's national interest. On the other hand, he also knew he had to appeal to France's ideals. He knew that France had a sense of belief in the romantic nature of the American struggle of liberty, of equality. Very difficult to do because France was run by Louis XVI, who was not naturally in favor of overturning monarchs. But still, he goes there and he publishes the Declaration of Independence. He wears this fur cap that he had picked up on some trip out to the wilderness and pretends he's the natural Rousseau philosopher from the frontier and the natural man from the uncorrupted state. And France totally falls in love with him. People paid money to get places on the streets so that when he was carried by to go to the academy, they'd have a good place to watch him going by. He was by far the most popular, famous person in Europe at the time.
Let's take another call. Richard's on the line from Muckwonago, Wisconsin. Richard, hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask you, you've talked about the Constitution and all men are created equal, and I'm very curious about whether what Franklin, as well as the other founding fathers, thought about Indians. It seems I read someplace one time when there was a massacre, if you want to call it that, way back then, that Franklin said something to the effect of extirpate the bastards, something to that effect.
And the massacre, which was a horrible massacre of the Indians.
Yes,
Franklin was fervently on the side of the Indians, and had got into this was one of the root causes of his battles with the Penn family in Pennsylvania. Oh. And he wrote a scathing pamphlet about the Lancashire and Paxton Boy massacres, it was called, in which he had a deep and abiding love for the Indians. More so, in fact, if he had a prejudice, it was against the frontier Presbyterians, he called them, the sort of Scotch and Irish who had settled the Pennsylvania frontier and were massacring the Indians. And he got into a religious war, because it was the only time he was ever accused of religious intolerance, was he took the side of the Indians against the Presbyterians. But in his most famous and diatribe of a pamphlet, he describes the life, the kindness, and the personality of each of the Indians who was massacred. I think there were 15 of them massacred at first, and he goes one by one through who they were, what they were like, how many children they had, and personalizes the whole thing. And he often told the tales, because, you know, he was supposed to go to Harvard. I know I'm speaking to partly a Boston audience up there. But his dad decided it would be a waste of money, perhaps rightly, to send him to Harvard, so he never gets to go. So he always has this bit of a resentment to Harvard. And he loved to tell the tale of the Harvard people who were with him on the frontier of Pennsylvania, who offered to take some of the Indians back and teach them at Harvard. And they said, no, we did that about 50 years ago, and they turned out to be useless, but we'll take some of your Harvard boys and teach them the ways of the Indian. And Franklin said, the Harvard people were afraid to do that because they knew that if somebody from Harvard learned the ways of the Indian, they would never go back to Harvard.
Well, Randall Kennedy's not here to defend Harvard tonight. Let's take another call. Gene's on the line from Watertown, Massachusetts. Gene, hi.
Hi. I'm curious about Franklin's relationship to the Mather family in Boston. I understand that Franklin had a friendly relationship with, I think it was Increase Mather?
Mainly Cotton Mather.
Cotton Mather.
Right.
And I was just curious, since you brought up earlier in the program his great contribution to the founding documents as being reason, what kind of relationship he had with these Puritan ministers?
Well, he rebelled against the Puritan ministers, and when he went to work for his brother's newspaper in Boston, they used to ridicule Cotton Mather and the Puritan ministers, sometimes badly. For example, they attacked the policy of smallpox inoculation because the Mathers were in favor of it. And in one of the horrible ironies of his life, Benjamin Franklin turns out to be in favor of smallpox inoculation, but his own four-year-old son dies of smallpox before he got to inoculate him. And so he talked to Cotton Mather about that and makes up with Cotton Mather later in life. He liked Cotton Mather's sense of reason, his Essays to Do Good, Bonifacius, that book by Cotton Mather, the Essays to Do Good book, was the most influential book of his childhood. He formed a lot of his civic associations based on the way Cotton Mather did. And he had a wonderful tale about humility that Cotton Mather taught him, which is he finally went back to visit Cotton Mather after he had run away from Boston. He comes back home. He comes to visit Mather to apologize for being part of his brother's circle attacking him in the New England Courant. And Mather accepts his apology, and they become very friendly. And as they're leaving the house, Cotton Mather says, "Stoop, stoop." And Franklin doesn't know what he's talking about and doesn't do anything. And so he bumps his head on a beam. And then Cotton Mather says, "Let that be a lesson to you. As you go through the world, always stoop and be willing to bow your head. It will save you a lot of hard knocks." And he said it was my first lesson in humility.
Joanna is on the line from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Joanna, hi.
Good evening. I have a question. I have read that Ben Franklin took some of the Iroquois Nation bicameral house. In thinking about the Constitution, he took that model, and I'd like some clarification on that.
Who did? Two things he took from the Iroquois Nation. First, their direct election and their system of the House. But also, when he wanted to forge in Albany, New York in 1754, a union of the colonies, he wanted to make a federal system back then because the colonies were all very independent of one another. He said, look, if the six nations of the Iroquois Confederation can do it, certainly we should be able to form a confederation, but they were not able to do it. But he was going to try to model the confederation of the United States on the six nations that formed the Iroquois nations.
Randall Kennedy, let's try and pull some threads together here. You've heard Walter Isaacson very eloquently making the case that Ben Franklin deserves to be up there in the pantheon with the greatest of the founding fathers. You started off being skeptical, I think. Are you persuaded in any way?
Mr. Isaacson's moved me a bit, I must say. He is his enthusiasm for Franklin, both through his print and also through speech, is moving. And he certainly communicates or helps to remind us of what an extraordinary gathering of men helped create the United States of America.
Walter Isaacson, American school kids, I know, learn about the Founding Fathers. They learn about Ben Franklin in school. If you were standing in front of them in class, what would you say to them? You've talked about religious tolerance, but what would you say to them today about why this man matters to them and matters to the country that they're growing up in?
I think I'd pick up on a point that Professor Kennedy made, which is, let's not deify the Founding Fathers. Let's remember they were human. Let's remember that they were made of flesh and blood. You know, let's remember that that they had their flaws, and let's wrestle with the slavery issue. Let's wrestle with the rights of man issue and stuff like that. Because only in wrestling with the Founding Fathers, rather than deifying them, are we going to truly understand the roots of our values as a nation. And I do think there's a problem when people write about the Founders and just sort of do it in marble instead of trying to show the real human behind the Founders.
Walter Isaacson, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for a wonderful book on Ben Franklin. Walter Isaacson joined us from New York, president of the Aspen Institute, former chairman of CNN, managing director of Time magazine, and author of the new biography, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life. Randall Kennedy, thank you very much as well. Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, a tribute to the comedian Buddy Hackett. This is On Point. Buddy Hackett, the round, rubbery-faced funny man who entertained audiences for more than 50 years in nightclubs, movies, television and Broadway shows, died yesterday. He was 78. Born Leonard Hacker in a Jewish section of Brooklyn, Hackett's early comedy career bombed until he started writing his own material. He gained a following through television appearances with Jackie Mason, Arthur Godfrey and Jack Parr, and before long he was headlining at major nightclubs across the country. Hackett appeared in more than 20 films during his career, and his critically acclaimed performance in Broadway's Lunatics and Lovers established him as more than a comedian. One of his idols was W.C. Fields, whose taboo-breaking style Hackett adopted. One of his most popular routines was an offensive impersonation of a Chinese waiter, and his bawdy, foul-mouthed routines were decades ahead of their time. On Point remembers Buddy Hackett tonight with an excerpt from one of his stand-up performances. Here, he jokes about his experience getting a physical when he signed up for the army. In true Hackett style, the language is a little crude.
When I went for the physical, that was the first time I had physical examination. 18 years old, nothing hurts, right? The guy said, take off your clothes, put them in a ball, put your shoes back on. You had to take your shoes off to get your pants off. They had peg pants in them days. Little tiny, like this, and big knees. And I find one shoe. I put it on. I'm going to bend down, look for no other shoe. It's 1,500 guys naked there. I don't know these people. Now there's a doctor, orthopedic doctor, orthopod, has a white line painted. He says, walk up and down on the line, see? So I'm walking on the line. He said, how long you been walking with a limp? I said, since I couldn't find my other shoe. What, are you a wise guy? No, I'm not a wise guy. Get out of here. I go in the next room. There's a doctor sitting by the desk. He's got a wooden chair. He's got wet in it. I was an upholsterer. Did you know I was an upholsterer? My grandfather was an upholsterer. My father was an upholsterer. My Uncle Harry was an upholsterer. Wooden chairs do not perspire. He says, sit down. No, thank you, sir. Sit down. And I sit down in this wooden chair in the wet. Do you have any communicable disease? Probably now. I didn't have any when I come in here. Did you have measles, mumps, chickenpox? Yes, sir. Scarlet fever? I don't think so. Any diabetes in your family? I don't know. Well, we have to have a specimen of your urine. Why don't you take what's on the chair here? You see the bottles up on the shelf? Yes, sir. I want a specimen of your urine in one of those bottles. Is it okay to stand on a chair? I can't reach that from here. What's the matter with you? Nothing's the matter with me. I'm just not pressurized for a 15-foot upward shot. I'm okay. You want to come down in the snow? I'll draw you a picture of a duck. He says, take the bottle down from the shelf. Oh, there's a trick. I didn't know there was a trick. I performed a specimen. I give him a real brimmer. He says, put your name on it. I said, who's going to steal a bottle of piss? Are you crazy? I should have had my name on my shoe. They grabbed that the minute I come in here.
The comedian Buddy Hackett, who died yesterday at his beach house in Malibu, California. He was 78. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.